This episode is sponsored by Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy is dedicated to providing 100% carbon-free energy by 2050, but they can't do it alone. They need your help. Join Xcel Energy and you'll find a purpose-driven career, solid job security, and challenging work. Xcel Energy knows the value your military service brings to the workplace. It's an exciting time to be in the energy industry. Whether you're on active duty, transitioning, or already embarking on your civilian career, learn about the opportunities with one of America's leading utilities, Xcel Energy, at xcelenergy.com/military. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and our goal is to help members of the military community succeed in their post-service career. Today's episode number 327, Bob Garfield's Purple Project for Democracy.
And I was at Arlington National Cemetery giving a tour to a foreign visitor not long ago. And, okay, I'm going to get a little choked up. I'm sorry. But, you know, after we toured this orchard of white marble and, you know, saw the names of the dead that represented, once again, every corner of American society. And what they had in common was the values. And they are everlasting and they are immutable. And we've kind of forgotten about them. We you know, we have literally, as a society, take freedom for granted. We mouth it a lot.
No matter what your political affiliation, I'm guessing that you're pretty upset about our country's state of affairs. In this interview, I talk with Bob Garfield, who, in addition to being one of the nation's foremost podcasters and writers, is also a co-founder for Purple Project for Democracy. Purple Project for Democracy is a nonpartisan coalition, campaign, and movement. They span the breadth of American society to rediscover and recommit to our democratic values. If you like this interview, be sure to check out episode number 70, Emily Chernaik, How New Politics is Helping Veterans of Both Parties Run for Office. I didn't have time to read Bob's bio prior to our interview, so here it is. Bob Garfield is co-host of Public Radio's weekly Peabody Award-winning On the Media. He is also the founding co-host of Slate's podcast on language, Lexicon Valley, and Amazon Channel's The Genius Dialogues. He is the founder of the Media Future Summit and on weekends is on a sporadic national tour with his one-man show, Ruggedly Jewish. A heroic multimediocrity, Bob has been a columnist or contributing editor for the Washington Post Magazine, The Guardian, Advertising Age, Civilization, and the op-ed page of USA Today. He has also written for the New York Times, Playboy, Atlantic, Sports Illustrated, Wired, and the Mianchi Shimbun, and been employed variously by ABC, CBS, CNBC, and the defunct FNN as an on-air analyst. As a lecturer and panelist, he has appeared in 37 countries on 6 continents. He wrote a shitty episode of a short-lived NBC sitcom, Sweet Surrender, and co-wrote a song recorded by Willie Nelson, which is a long story. He is a 5-time New York Times worst-selling author. His sixth book, American Manifesto, will be published in early 2020. As always, at beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find show notes with links to everything we discuss. And with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Bob Garfield.
Dive.
Joining me in Washington, D.C., my guest today is Bob Garfield. Bob, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you, Justin. Pleasure to be here.
And I just wanted to catch what you were just saying. So we are catching you on the verge of a 2.5-day weekend extravaganza of recording your next audiobook, which I imagine is this is a warm-up exercise for that, for your voice. What's the book and what's it about?
The book is called American Manifesto. It's published January 14th, and it is a polemic. It is a cri de coeur. It's trying to find how we got to this spot in American society where the polarization is so apparently ruinous and I'm a senior American, and I sometimes can't think of words, so I'm going to actually answer the question this way. Well, it's called American Manifesto. It is published on January 14th. It's a polemic. You can actually, as you read it, see the spittle flying from my mouth. And it takes a pretty unusual path to trying to understand how we as a society got where we are with the polarization and an extraordinary willingness of, and we'll talk about this more, among Americans, especially young Americans, to give up on democracy itself. And the book pins it on a combination of identity, American obsession with identity, which has played out in identity politics in various ways, and also technology, the social media, and how it has trapped us in filter bubbles of our own ideology, and to the point that other ideas simply cannot penetrate. So the combination of those two has created this extraordinary moment in history. That's what that's about, but that's not what I'm working on, you know, right now.
That's great. And for listeners, I just want to be right from the get-go, just let you know that my intention, I think Bob's intention as well, like we want to have this discussion today, and I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I don't care what your political affiliations are. Very early in Beyond the Uniform, it was episode 30 or something, I interviewed Emily Chernayak, who runs an organization called New Politic. She helps people on both sides of the aisle get into politics, veterans on both sides of the aisle. And I just loved that from the start of just thinking like, man, even if the person is on the opposing political end of the spectrum, I still trust someone who's worn the uniform, who, you know, swore to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. I trust them more in politics. I want to see them more in politics and government service. And what we're going to talk about today is the work that Bob is doing. It's called Purple for Democracy. We're just going to do a deep dive on that organization. And from this is just my opinion. My opinion is, you know, many of us wore the uniform because we wanted to protect our country. We wanted to protect democracy in our country. And when we take off that uniform, I think that intention still resides. And I think what we're going to be talking about will be interesting for listeners in uniform and out of uniform to learn about how we can continue to serve and protect the country that we all love. And so, Bob, maybe to start off, could you share a little bit more about the origin story of Purple for Democracy?
Sure. The origin story was based on another project that I was involved in called the Media Future Summit. Mm-hmm. And that was an attempt over 4 or 5 years partnership with the University of Pennsylvania to try to locate sustainable, ethical revenue streams and business models for the media sector, which is in a spiraling vortex of ruin. The very Facebook and Google, which we'll be discussing later as culprits in our current circumstances, have also destroyed the advertising model that supported media for more than 300 years. And as a consequence, journalism, which we depend on, you know, constitutionally guaranteed Fourth Estate, which we depend on, is on the brink of death. Mm. I mean, there's no other way to put it. And its resources have been diminished by more than half, newspapers closing, magazines closing faster, no one covering the state house or the school board, city council, the zoning hearing board. We in the media simply cannot perform the function that we are designed to do. We cover national politics just fine. I mean, you can't avoid that stuff. But as to the rest of media, you know, there is very much a news desert taking over the country, where there is no coverage of our local government and its other institutions. So that was the project. And I got to know a guy named Jerry Wind, Professor Yoram Wind, a professor of marketing at Wharton, who was my partner in this thing. And Jerry, a lifelong Republican, was wringing his hands about the polarization and a set of data points, which he became acquainted with, that showed that 30% of the American public is willing to try something beyond democracy, including, Justin, authoritarianism and army rule. Army rule. And so on the presumption that that's the wrong path, that we shouldn't be throwing out the democracy baby with the political chaos bathwater, he asked that I have a call with him and another colleague, Rebecca Winthrop, who is an education specialist at the Brookings Institution, a think tank here in Washington, to see what, if anything, we can do about it. And that was 19 months ago. And what came out of that phone call was something we call the Purple Project for Democracy. And the idea is to re-educate, inspire, set up the context and the stakes of surrendering democracy, and locating core values, and kind of, and sometimes we discuss it as marriage encounter, which you may be too young to remember, but in the 60s and the 70s, it was this gimmick where you go, you and your wife, you know, you once were madly in love, but now you're 10 years married, you got rugrats running around the house, the spark is, you know, is gone. So you go to a resort and say in some, you know, cold conference room for the weekend, making goo-goo eyes at one another and holding hands and trying to remember, you know, how you became a couple to begin with. And I think our democracy needs a little bit of marriage encounter, because there are shared values that transcend any transitory political disagreement. And so that's what Purple is about, to get people, to remind people how we got here and why we love American freedom. And not to whitewash the sins and failures of American democracy, there's a whole mess of them, but to say that, you know, whatever you think about this country, it is a hell of a lot better than North Korea and Russia and Myanmar and Venezuela and Nicaragua and Bolivia and Turkey and Ukraine and Poland and Hungary and Turkey and Philippines and the Republic of Congo. And I could go on and on and on, where nobody there can take for granted the political and personal freedoms we, nobody can, is given, I should say, is granted the political and personal freedoms that we have here. So that's the idea. And the second phase of this thing, which, you know, will commence later, is to create a platform where people can, kind of like Tinder for democracy, where you can hook up with opportunities to be a part of your community from Zip Plus 4 all the way to Inside the Beltway. And as you do, the more you do, the sort of more social badging you can do. And over a period of time, there will be a social benefit towards being a full-fledged citizen, and perhaps a corresponding social liability for checking out and being complacent. And the goal is that in 5 years, in the same way that friends no longer let friends drive drunk, friends will not let friends check out. That's the master plan. But for now, we're just trying to reawaken Americans to the singular glories of American democracy.
I love that. I'm blanking on the person's name, but I interviewed in the last 6 months someone where their organization is dedicated to national security, and they bring in people from the tech center and from every background. And these are backgrounds that usually don't have a lot of overlap, but the premise that's been succeeding is the discussion by multiple vantage points leads to a better outcome than any one of them in isolation. And the contrasting of the tension really between opposing viewpoints led them to come up with the superior solution for technology. And for those of you who have listened to the Saturday episodes of Beyond the Uniform, we talk a lot about discomfort and the value of being able to tolerate discomfort. And one thing I just wanted to surface, Bob, is I have political ideals and political views very opposed to much of my family. And we don't even talk about it. Like I'm like somewhat close with my family, and we just, it's like such a sore spot that there's not even a dialogue there. And I'm just wondering, I know this is a little bit off script, but as I'm saying this, I'm like, I know that to engage in a dialogue would create discomfort and tension. And I know theoretically the value of that tension and discomfort. I know that I love these people. I respect them. I have deep ties to them. So I know in theory we can, you know, if I can't have the discussion with them, I can't have the discussion with anyone. And I'm imagining, regardless of what side of the divide people are on, they feel somewhat the same, which is there isn't a dialogue. There's kind of either I talk about it with people who feel the exact same as me, or I change the topic as quickly as, you know, I treat it as like a minefield. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on...
That's because it's a minefield, as we all,
all
know. That's why, you know, the truism, you know, never talk religion or politics, because it's always going to end up in a fight. However, look where that has gotten us, right? Look where we are as a society following that truism. And so it's funny you should mention that, because, mm-hmm. well, first of all, I want to say that any of your listeners who go to wethepurple.org, wethepurple.org, if they look and see our coalition, they will see, just as you described, a very diverse group of institutional partners who really span the breadth of American society, politics, and culture. You know, this is not a politically inflected enterprise. In fact, all of the content partners who produce the content that we feature on our website, they have to swear, you know, on the eyes of their children that they will not, none of that content will be political, ideological, partisan, or even based on policy. It is all about reawakening our sense of shared purpose. So, you know, we're on the same page there. But here's the thing. If you go to wethepurple.org, you will see our biggest initiative. Let's say it's a stunt, but it's more than a stunt. Mm. It's called the Great Thanksgiving Taking. And what we are asking young people to do is to go to Thanksgiving dinner this year, not just to go to it, and be marginalized the way young people always are. You know, they're not asked to speak. They're supposed to pipe down. They're often sitting at another table while the adults are in the main room squabbling with one another about politics. And we're asking them to hijack the holiday, to take over, to program it along purple lines. And we give them a toolkit for doing that. And for turning a family Thanksgiving dinner, which, as you know, often quickly reverts into some horrible family psychodrama. Mm. We're asking them to devote some time to reflecting on our democracy. And we give them mechanisms for doing that. We give them a game, a charades game. We give them purple recipes. We encourage them to dress grandpa in purple, even though grandpa's not, you know, necessarily into dressing up along a theme. And most importantly, we have a label that you can print out and put around a regular can of peas or whatever, called the can of democracy. And whoever holds that can, it's a kind of like a tribal talking stick. Whoever holds the can as it's passed around the table can reflect on democracy, on our society, what it means to them, what our future is, what our common ground is, what it really means to be an American. And when you've said your piece, no matter how old you are, you pass it along. And in this way, we are asking the youngest Americans, we are literally giving them a voice. It's not just a stunt, it's actually a microcosm of the voicelessness of the next generation, which is going to be given a voice and heavily influence the future of this society. So it's called the Great Thanksgiving Taking. If I would encourage the kids to participate, mostly I would say, if the kids come home from school and say, here's what we're doing on Thanksgiving, and we will brook no resistance. Listen to them, because it's going to turn what should be our most meaningful national celebration into something truly special.
I love that too, because I love the phrase you used earlier, which is tuning out, or, you know, I get that sense. I get that sense of my own life as well, of just kind of like, there's so much pain and anger there. It's just easier to turn on Netflix. It's just easier to like tune it out rather than sit with that. And what I would say for listeners that comes up as you're saying this, Bob, is, you know, every listener who's worn the uniform, I don't care if you're an E1 all the way to 08 or whatever rank you are a leader. You have been trained in leadership. Even if the majority of your time in the military has been following, I guarantee you have this bedrock of leadership. And what comes to me when you say that, Bob, is like recognizing like the ways in which I'm abdicating my leadership in my family by not brokering a peace talk, by not finding the common ground. And I would encourage listeners, I'll put that in the show notes for WeThePurple.org and the Great Thanksgiving Taking, but to use that as an opportunity, as a leadership challenge, and recognize, and I love what Bob threw out.
Can I just say, to cultivate leadership in your children. Mm. Because part of parental leadership is to create a next generation that itself has the leadership chops and the self-confidence and the scope to do for their children what I hope you have done for yours. So it's all part of the great circle of life. And I just don't, you know, I think this just hits on every note.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I mean, I love that too. I know many listeners have kids and I love that sense of like, what a gift to give them that leadership opportunity within the family and to show them. I imagine many of us have common values of respect and tolerance and things like that. And that was one of the things I was going to ask about. You mentioned a couple of times finding common ground. What have you found to be some of that common ground that we do share?
Well, it just so happens that we are speaking on November 11th, which is Veterans Day, which used to be called Armistice Day. Mm. And I was at Arlington National Cemetery giving a tour to a foreign visitor not long ago. And, I'm going to get a little choked up. I'm sorry. Mm. But, you know, after we toured this orchard of white marble and you know, saw the names of the dead that represented once again every corner of American society, you go into the visitor center and it's kind of a mini museum, and in the mini museum is a very large photograph, and it's a photograph of the day of Armistice Day in 1919, right? That was the end of the war. In any event, 100 years later, we're sitting there looking at this picture. And there are a million people in this throng of people celebrating the end of this horrendous war. And this was taking place in Philadelphia. And at the center of this celebration was a scale model of the Statue of Liberty. Now, it was a scale model, but it was only about 50% scale. It was still enormous. They had built a replica of Lady Liberty in downtown Philadelphia, and there were a million people there paying tribute to it. And I thought, wow, a million people, again, representing every dimension of American society. And what they had in common was the values embedded in that piece of bronze. And they are everlasting and they are immutable, and we've kind of forgotten about them. We have literally as a society take freedom for granted. We mouth it a lot. For example, you know, I notice that when we're celebrating on Veterans Day by watching the Cowboys Vikings game, and we see the NFL tributes to our men and women in uniform, they are constantly using the phrase defending our freedoms. And it has become meaningless because I don't think we as a society are giving thought to what those freedoms are, what they are. And the whole idea of the Purple Project is to remind people what freedom really is so that we don't sacrifice it over some momentary, you know, political frustration. I no longer even remember the question.
No, that's perfect.
Standing there at the Arlington Cemetery with tears literally streaming down my cheeks. Because, you know, we've sort of let Lady Liberty be a stranger. And I want her invited back to the Thanksgiving table.
And it's a powerful image for those who have been to Arlington to think of the uniform headstones, all granite and marble. And there is no red, there is no blue, there's no religion. Like it is in death is like the ultimate form of unification where there are all these people side by side, different ethnicities, different beliefs, everything. And those were people that died protecting our democracy, protecting our freedom. And I'm sure they did not agree on many things, but they agreed on a willingness to do whatever it took to keep that safe. And what you're describing is a similar unification to say like, okay, of course we have squabbles. Of course, we'll always have differences. Of course, we'll always have things we dislike about each other. And what we're doing together is bigger than that. What we are protecting exceeds our own personal likes and dislikes, what we believe in and what we're doing for future generations engulfs that and overshadows that. I think that's really a beautiful image of that. That cemetery is the representation of that.
Well, that's what We the Purple seeks to reclaim.
How can listeners get involved if they're, we already talked about the great Thanksgiving taking. What are other ways, if they're encouraged by what you're sharing, that they could support in different ways?
Well, if you go to wethepurple.org, you'll see a number of things. One of them is a whole mess of content provided by 50-some content providers. It's educational. It's essays. There's some plain reporting, but it all gets to the theme of our American democracy. So it's quite a trove of really enlightening material. Another thing you will see, and it is a 76, get it? 76? Things you can do to participate in democracy right now. And you can imagine that it's all sorts of things, but you know, everything from voting, which I guess is baseline, to participating in your local government, to canvassing for a candidate, to running for local office, to being a poll watcher, to starting or joining a garden club that puts flowers around your local monuments or government buildings. Or you know other public places in the public square, to literally do something to contribute and to once again get in the spirit of self-sacrifice and shared interest. So 76 of them, which is not a small number, and this is kind of a down payment on what we will eventually do by creating a platform to connect with opportunities in your community. On this geosensitive platform that knows where you live based on your IP address and kind of keeps track of your progress as an active citizen. So, you know, there's that. And there's some of our social media messaging, and there is a funny series of videos, I mean, funny and also chilling, that called WTP News, We the Purple News. And it looked, these videos look exactly like local news broadcasts. Wherever you live, they look just like the local news, but they take place in a version of America that's not democratic, that is run by a tyrant named Most Generous Leader. If you pay any attention at all, you'll see it's a lot different. It looks exactly the same as today's America, but it sure isn't exactly the same. So there's a whole mess of stuff there But the most important thing is how to participate, whether in this one day great Thanksgiving taking or in the longer term stuff on the list of 76 things you can do. Yep. You can also join. You can get our, you know, you can get our newsletter, follow our blog. You can donate money. Money is nice, but it, you have to look for the donate button because it's not the main goal of this thing. We have gotten where we have on spit and bailing wire. Hmm. It's not, you know, it's not a money raising operation. And you can, I think just a visit to the site will remind you that we're all in this together.
What I love about the 76 things you can do to participate in democracy right now, I imagine most people can relate to this feeling I often have of hopelessness, and that sense of hopelessness makes me want to tune out and just give up. And the enormity of the challenge of reversing this momentum that has led us to bickering rather than building the best country we can together, that enormity makes me even more reluctant to take action. And so I love the thought of just having a list of even bite-sized actions, tiny things that, yes, they're not going to completely change things overnight. They're not going to end things immediately, but just reminding myself that every little piece makes a difference. Every little step does move things forward. And I love, you know, it seems like the undercurrent of what you're doing, Bob, with Purple for Democracy is realizing that if we can get people, lots of different people, to take small actions as a starting point, those can build. Those can start to build understanding and a dialogue, and that can lead, you know, start big movements start small. So I love the tactical nature of those 76 reasons and just making it easy for people to take action.
Well, you're exactly right, and I can prove it, Justin, because while we're in the midst of partisan gridlock on the national and maybe state house level, if you want to see where democracy works, all you have to do is go to the 98% of the rest of America, municipalities, of which there are thousands and thousands and thousands, where, by and large, democracy works just fine. Mm. Citizens cooperating and participating on various levels, where you can fight City Hall, where your your desires and interests will be addressed, where your participation is necessary. And, you know, if you go around the country from town hall to courthouse and so forth, you will see that everything's working fine. Now, obviously, there are places that are corrupt, where there's undue influence by certain, you know, powerful interests, and where democracy is really dictated by a few powerful people. But that's the exception, not the rule. And, you know, the situation, in fact, is not hopeless. And that being able to participate at a local level, even your planned community, you know, board of neighbors will remind you and reaffirm that cooperative participatory citizenship is our lifeblood. And the trick is to take that ethic, which we seem to understand and internalize locally, and transfer it to national politics, which is going to take some doing, but WeThePurple.org is a start.
I love that. And I love even the mock videos that you have. One thing that surfaces for me is that listeners we have who have, you know, served in Afghanistan and Iraq, like who have seen in very dramatic ways what can happen when you don't have the government structures that we do. I think many listeners in our audience have seen the extremities that can come about when you don't have these things that we take for granted. And I think it's very easy for us to forget of, you know, I was born in the US. I've always known this. I've lived a very safe and secure life. And much of the world is not like that. And to realize that, yes, it's easy to start nitpicking on things that aren't going well and ignoring and not appreciating all the incredible things that are going well and that are not necessarily immutable. Like they're not going to be there forever unless we continue to support it. And so that might be something for listeners to check out, is just that kind of mock look at a reminder of the things that we might not even realize we need to be appreciating right now.
You know how your local police cars on the side, it often says something like to protect and serve. Well, it's not just the cops that need to be doing that. We are, you know, first responders are absolutely necessary, but this society doesn't work based only on first responders. It is the great everyone else. We also have to protect what has been granted us by the Constitution, and we have to serve, and we just can't outsource it to our men and women in uniform, whether in the military or in police departments around the country. And it's easy to do that because, oh, we got people for that. We don't got people for that. Mm-hmm. In the end, it's us.
I love that. One other thing, I know this is a little bit off script too, but when at the start, when you were talking about the media, it made me think back to 2000, so nearly 20 years ago, when I was at the Naval Academy. We had a training and it was on hazing.
Whoa. You were at the Naval Academy?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh my gosh. I knew you were a nice guy. I didn't know you were smart.
I don't usually exude that. I kind of keep it hidden. And the training was on hazing. And I remember, you know, the Naval Academy is such a cynical, funny group of people, but the question was posed to us, like, why do we have hazing? And someone, you know, obviously in the back of the room throughout, because the media gets a hold of it. And we laughed, and like the sense was, you know, hazing was something good. It was our thing. And the only reason it's a big deal is because the media gets a hold of it and then turns it into something that it's not. And that thread was in much of my service, just my own experience speaking for myself, of almost like this antagonistic relationship that the media was somehow out to get us. The media was like, you had to be on guard when you were talking to the media. You had to be buttoned up. And you know, I've been out of uniform for over 10 years now and don't hold that opinion at all. But I did want to just make space to talk about that, where I imagine some listeners may be in that mindset of feeling like the media in some way right now is the enemy, or the media in some way is contributing or exacerbating this problem. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, Bob, but I just wanted to chime in and say that, like, I've grown to appreciate the complex ecosystem that makes our democracy possible, and the necessary balance of checks and balances, and the role that the media plays in shining a spotlight and uncovering things. And not to get to extremes, but I always do go back to 1940s Germany and thinking of, like, wow, what happens if the system is unchecked, and realizing in Nazi Germany how important the press was and how important that voice was, and what can happen, the atrocities that can happen when that's suppressed. And so I just wanted to make space, Bob, if you have any thoughts on that. I know that's just kind of out of nowhere, but it's something that surfaced for me as we were talking.
Well, I do have thoughts about it because, as you know, my day job is the co-host of a show called On the Media. Mm-hmm. For 20 years, these are issues that I have been thinking about, you know, all day, every day. And, you know, I'll answer you in a couple of ways. First is that you don't have to go to Nazi Germany to kind of put this in perspective. All you have to do is go to Bell, California. Bell, California is a little town. It's in the county of Los Angeles, but it's like 30 miles away from the Staples Center. And it is a working class suburb. It's like 30 or 40,000 people. And they're on the lower end of the national income scale. It's not underclass, but it's very blue collar. There's a significant, although not overwhelming, amount of unemployment. It's just a basic bedroom community, but it's located in a place where the Los Angeles Times — I told you about the shrinkage of the newspaper business. The Los Angeles Times stopped covering it long ago because it was too far out, and the Orange County Register also didn't cover it, and the local weekly newspapers that generally had covered those areas had gone out of business or dramatically reduced their coverage due to lack of resources. So there was Bell, California, and the only attention it got from the local press was a weekly paper, you know, maybe two or three towns over, that would call in and get the reports of the city council meeting once a month. And the way they would get the reports is they would talk to one of the city councilmen, I think the chairman, who would tell them what had taken place at the meeting. That was all the public knew about Bell, California. So what they didn't know was that over a period of 5 or 7 years, the Bell, California City Council was awarding itself salaries in the hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. The president of the council was making more than $1 million a year, fleecing the taxpayer and covering the cost of this gigantic swindle by having the highest tax rates of any place in Southern California. So these people who were least able to afford it were paying the, were underwriting the lifestyles of the rich and not so famous, the lifestyles of the rich and infamous Bell City Councilmen. And the reason was, is because the watchdog wasn't on the beat. Nobody knew it was happening, and so it happened. And that is one of the major missions of the American media. We, in fact, are in the fault-finding business. Now, we also cover, you know, where was the fire engine going and what happened. You know, we talk about stuff that happens. In other words, news. But one of our major roles is to be a watchdog for government and other institutions of society. And that's why the framers understood our role and protected us with the First Amendment. But the theory being that the First Amendment that protects the media also protects you. Now, when you're in the fault-finding business, it becomes instinctive to find fault. That is a kind of mentality. It's a mindset. It's not an ideological skew. It's not partisan. It's just in your DNA. And the problem is when you are involved in something that is a fault, and someone calls you out for it, you begin to attribute other factors to the situation. Oh, well, they're just this, or they're just that. They're just selling newspapers. They're under the thumb of George Soros or the Koch brothers. They're usually just looking for good meaty stories about things that should raise your eyebrows. Now, the media are also a fast-moving institution, and sometimes we screw up. But one good thing about us is that when we do screw up, we take accountability for it, and we run corrections, and we correct the record, and so forth. As to hazing, I'm not going to weigh in because I don't know much about hazing. I do know that when you find fault with it, you are criticizing years, decades, sometimes centuries of tradition, and an institution like the Naval Academy, tradition is very, very important. But at some point, it becomes worthwhile to ask the question: Is the tradition worth the consequences? And I'm not familiar with the particulars, but it's a pretty good example of how when the press does its job, the hard feelings can follow immediately. What happened with hazing at the Naval Academy?
I think this was particularly just a required training. It was less for me about hazing when I was remembering it, and more just the thought of that something is made bad because it was tainted by someone outside of us. And in this case, it was the media. And I think that just for me, I think that can be a dangerous path of kind of like a insular group, that any sort of outside spotlight, any sort of outside scrutiny is looked down upon. And I certainly, you know, when I was in the Naval Academy, I definitely identified with that. And I saw friends get in trouble for things, and I developed the story. And, you know, as I've gotten older, I think I've shifted my thinking on that to realize, like, you know, just like I was very jaded about all the procedures we had on submarines, and I realized, you know, it can feel very robotic. And you also realize that those procedures are usually in place because there was some sort of catastrophic failure that was associated with equipment or loss of life, and the procedures, while they slowed things down, on the whole, they led to a safer environment for everyone. I feel very similarly with external scrutiny from the media or whatever else it is, that, you know, yes, of course, there's pain points and there's friction. And if we look at the, if we take the 10,000 foot view instead of the man on the ground position, like, there is a purpose here. And again, it's by no means perfect, but it is the evolutionary step towards us growing as a species, growing as a country, and developing into the best country we can possibly be.
Well, I would say this, as a general principle, if you were concerned about scrutiny from the outside, whether it be from the media or from the judge advocate general, or from some do-gooder organization, or dissident shareholders, or whatever it is, if you're worried about the scrutiny, think about that.
Yeah.
Why are you worried? Because if you can stand up to the scrutiny, if whatever it is that is generating the scrutiny is defensible and just fine, well, I guess you get nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Actually, we both know that sometimes you have something to worry about, because sometimes outsiders literally don't understand. They make assumptions. Mm-hmm. They impute one set of values onto you that aren't necessarily your shared values. But nonetheless, I say, as a general rule, if you're worried about other people looking at what you're up to, give some hard thought as to what you're up to.
Mm, I love it. One other thing that I really appreciate about the work you're doing with Purple for Democracy, I recently did an interview with Jason Jackson, who works in government service in Nebraska. I've done a couple episodes with politicians, and
Justin, yeah. Did I say judge adjutant general?
No, you said, I think you said advocate.
Advocate.
No, I think you're good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I think when I think of what you're doing with Purple for Democracy, my mind immediately goes towards actually either elected or unelected political office. And what I love about what you're saying is, like, if I'm hearing this right, it's like, it's not about that. It's incumbent on all of us as citizens to play an active role in our democracy. It's incumbent on us as citizens to have a voice and to be proactive and to take action. And I love that. I hope that listeners take that as a very proactive message of realizing, even if we've been out of the military for 20 years, we still have that duty to be active voices. And as you've said, to give voice to our children and make sure that everyone is heard in part as part of that discussion and dialogue.
Yeah. And look, as I said, our organization it covers the breadth of society, right? Mm. But as you say, I think the prevailing ethic of military families of service makes it somehow even more of a natural fit. Mm-hmm. That I can hardly think of a sector of the society where the idea of accepting your role as an active citizen is more natural and more important, because it's just an extension of what you've done when you have been in uniform. And now, it's not for me to tell you or any other veteran what they need to be doing with their life. I'm just saying it's just strikes me as being a natural extension of what you signed up for when you were 18 years old.
I love it. Well, I always like to make space at the end, and we've covered a lot of ground. I'm sure there's things we didn't talk about. So either what have we not covered you want listeners to know, or what are some final words of wisdom you'd like to leave them with?
Well, we've talked a lot about political disagreement. And as I mentioned, Purple is absolutely, utterly, defiantly, militantly nonpartisan, non-policy, non-everything. You know, it's just about rekindling trust, faith, and devotion to American democracy. But I just think this calls for transparency. It's true that our coalition covers the whole waterfront. I myself am just about as ultra-liberal as you can get. And anyone who has heard my show knows how I feel about, for example, the current administration and about a whole bunch of other stuff where, you know, you go down the checklist and I'm almost a caricature of American progressive thought. I mean, I tell people I'm borderline Sandinista, which really isn't true, but it's a good laugh line. Anyway, and wearing the uniform I wore was the Cub Scouts, and I was a really shitty Cub Scout. So there's a cultural gap between what I presume to be the largest part of your audience and me. But there's no gap at all, because we're all in this together, and we all have the same responsibility and commitment to preserving our democracy. And we cannot, whether you're on the political left or the political right, you cannot let your frustration, your misgivings about any given piece of policy at any given time, permit you to lose faith in the extraordinary idea that has kept us going for 243 years. And you don't need to reach hands across the aisle. That's not what purple's about. It's not about dialogue, which I'm all for. I mean, I believe in comedy and dialogue, but that's not what it's for. It's about shared values. And I just can't imagine anything about wanting to preserve American democracy that should create a moment of conflict or tension anywhere along the political spectrum. So as we were saying from the get-go, we are all in this together.
I love it. Well, Bob, thank you for your time today. Thank you for the work you're doing with Purple for Democracy and the contribution that is to our country. And thank you for sharing your story with Beyond the Uniform today.
Thank you, Justin. I'm delighted to chat with you.
Surface.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Quick couple admin points. We release brand new episodes every single Monday and Thursday. Those are usually recorded about a month or so before they go live. Every Monday and Thursday, we have an interview, usually almost always with a military veteran about their civilian career. More and more, we're starting to add in experts who may not be veterans, but may have some expertise that will help the military veteran community. Saturdays, I typically post more of a behind the scenes episode, which is a free form format. I try to use what I'm calling a mullet format. And by that, I mean business up front, party in the back, talking through admin points, professional topics related to the podcast. It might be a conversation I had that week. It might have been an interview I had that week, but just trying to share things that are top of mind that may help you in more of a free form, straight from the heart format. And then the party in the back is the personal side of things, just kind of more free flowing thoughts on life, on improving oneself, just kind of whatever's going on in life and trying to be authentic and honest about those things as well. Special thanks. We have an all volunteer army of people behind Beyond the Uniform making this possible. We do this on our lunch breaks, on our evenings, on our weekends, because we love the military community. We want to give back. We want to make a difference. We want that as part of the purpose in our life that we valued in the military. So special thanks to Steve Bain. Steve does pretty much everything. He helps secure guests. He does our newsletter. He keeps the reels rolling and keeps me sane. Kathleen Dillon, the first person to join our team. She writes text transcripts of every single episode. It's wild. She keeps up with two of these a week, despite a demanding career and education right now. But those transcripts help us get more SEO value, helps her audience more. Andrew Woolridge is our data guru. He helps us understand the numbers, which is the easiest way for us to figure out how we can better support you, and adds kind of the data oversight for that. Rick Healy does all of our social media. He is gaining more and more of an audience for us by getting our videos, getting our podcasts out on social channels. The best way to stay in contact with us is if you go to beyondtheuniform.org. There is a newsletter. You'll have a little pop-up that comes up. You can put your email in. We email twice per month. We try to be respectful, but it is a great way to get appraised of upcoming events, upcoming interviews, promos where companies are giving discounts to Beyond the Uniform listeners, and more. This does cost money to put on. We are committed to not charging veterans directly. And the way that we kind of offset costs is through corporate sponsors. So if you know of a company that would like to get in front of a military audience and their families, that's one way that we can both add value to our members, but also offset the costs of Beyond the Uniform and give us a little bit of budget to start expanding what we're doing. So that's the best way you can help us. If that's not something that you can do, a positive review on iTunes is greatly appreciated. Have a wonderful week. We will be back Monday, Thursday, and Saturday with more interviews. And keep up the listening. Take care.